Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Paymar, and you are listening to The Big Shift, the podcast that looks at the seismic changes our world and our country confront. Today, we're looking into a subject of critical importance, the right to vote, hold fair elections across the country, and how the vote may take shape in November 23 and 24. Will the suburban areas of America decide the winner? Who is the suburban voter today and what resonates with them? My next guest is Lawrence Levy. He's the executive dean of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University in New York. Prior to his academic life, Levy spent 35 years as a reporter, editorial writer, and columnist for Newsday, a major New York newspaper. He was a finalist for the prestigious Pulitzer Prize in Journalism and has won numerous top awards for coverage on suburban politics, education, taxation, and housing. He frequently appears on New York TV and radio as an expert on the political scene. Larry, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us today on The Big Shift.
Well, thank you for reaching out to me and including me in your podcast.
Larry, you grew up in suburban Long Island, New York. Suburbs began to really evolve after the end of World War II. Everyone wanted a single family home, a car parked in the garage, and a picket fence. Then, as the decades passed, we saw many young people, they grew up in the suburbs, but they headed back to the city where they felt life was a little bit more exciting. They didn't have to commute to work. Then 2020, and the coronavirus pandemic. We saw people fleeing the city for the burbs, and now many people who moved out are moving back in. So my question to you is, who are the people who comprise the suburbs today?
They comprise everybody, and that's actually a distinction with a difference. You know, when my folks moved out to Long Island in 1955, everything was new. They moved into a house nobody had lived in. The lawn was new. The spindly trees were new. Even the sewers underneath the streets were new. And everybody was also white. I mean, they were all, there was a smattering of Latinos, almost all Puerto Ricans. There were a couple of historic Black communities, but basically it was white and untroubled by crime and pollution and all the ills that folks were fleeing the suburbs for, and wide open spaces as well, and new schools. Flash forward, and now a place like Long Island, which is a lot like suburbs all over the country, are feeling a lot more urban, whether it is crowding, whether it is pollution, whether it is pockets of poverty that have kind of grown to suitcase size, if you will. And in terms of even demographic, Long Island, and again, a lot of other suburbs around the country are approaching majority non-white status. And for somebody who came out here in 1955, that's hard to imagine.
Larry, you're aging yourself there.
Well, I am old. I am in the suburbs, in fact. And these are not just interesting, you know, fun suburban fact. They've had an enormous impact on the nation's life, economic life, its academic life, and particularly on its political life. You know, back in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s, suburban communities around the country were very reliable Republican places. Used to call them, what was it, Jim? Rock-ribbed Republicans. Now that would be known as a red community.
Right.
So, but over the years, the suburbs began to evolve, and they went from red to pink, a little bit of competitiveness, to purple.
And now blue.
And there was a little kind of a blip in the last couple of years following the confusion of the pandemic. But most suburbs around the country are trending toward blue. And that has made a number of states more competitive rather than less. And the locus of that competition is outside the city, but not quite as far as the country.
You know, Larry, many people left the big cities for the suburbs during the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s because people of color were moving into the cities. And we saw the riots after the Martin Luther King assassination in 1968. Cities were burned out. Some, like Detroit and Newark, they're still struggling to recover. Millions moved to the suburbs. However, one statistic I found said that today 45% of our suburban communities are comprised of people of color. And you just mentioned that.
Yeah, right.
How do you view that transition?
It's complicated, as they say.
Yeah.
In part reflect the growing economic power of people of color. These are folks who can support the higher prices, at least in terms of purchasing homes out in suburban communities. And they want the same things that my parents wanted. They want better schools. They want more open space. They want more control over the decisions that government and school boards make. In some cases, they are moving to communities of color that are growing. And in some cases, they're moving to places that were once white and some that are still completely integrated. So
right.
In some ways, it's a good thing that reflects progress. The problem is in many suburbs, we are, even though if you look from the 20,000 foot view, a place again like Long Island, you know, so-called America's first suburb, you know, from 20,000 feet, it looks completely integrated. Like I said, we're moving towards no ethnic or racial group having a majority. But if you go down to the 10, 5 or 1,000 foot, you know, the runway view,
it's one of the most segregated areas of the country.
Exactly. We may be much more diverse, but we are no less segregated. And if we are less, it's not by very much.
You mentioned that as minorities become more populous and they increase their wealth, what is this going to mean both for suburban and urban areas? In extreme cases, a place like Las Vegas, where the minority share of its suburbs rose from 26% in 1990 to 66% in 2020. So they're by far a majority.
Las Vegas, for example, which is a municipality north of Las Vegas, is majority Latino. It's a middle-class, working-class community. It was one of the fastest-growing suburbs in America, not just the fastest-growing, you know, featuring the fastest-growing cohort of non-white people, but all people. Blacks, Latinos, and Asians are having a profound impact on all aspects of suburban life. And I know you started out the podcast talking about politics, and I think the impact may have been most profound in the political arena. It's one of the major reasons that these suburban communities have moved towards purple or light blue status. You have all these folks who brought their capital D Democratic voting tendencies with them to Nassau County and to Suffolk County, for example, and to Bucks County, and these folks are still voting Democratic. So one of the reasons that the suburbs changed is that the people living there are not the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think, Larry, that we're going to see a move back to the urban core as cities kind of climb out of this doom loop that was caused by COVID? Or will suburbs just keep expanding?
It depends on the suburb. Long Island, for example, is on an island, and there's a limit to how much it can expand. Out west, outside of Denver, the land just goes on, and you know they could conceivably annex more territory and expand the city. And this is true in some other areas as well. It's an open question. You know, the city, it really depends on the city. New York City has been written off, for instance, so many times, and has proven those write-offers wrong.
Yeah, I just saw the old headline, Ford to New York, drop dead.
Or the cover of, I think it was Time, that showed a rotten apple. You know? I wish I'd bought real estate on the downside. So, and I think that what is probably going to happen in a lot of metro areas, and what is actually best for the regions that comprise city and suburbs, is when there is a balance, when there, and even some kind of collaboration on issues like pollution, mass transportation, when cities and suburbs work together, and both are integrated, not just racially, but economically and in other ways.
Boy, that's a big stretch, Larry. Big cities and the suburbs working together. I mean,
think about it, Jim. And if I hadn't been forced to spend a lot of time, you know, looking into the weeds on this stuff, I would have the same reaction. But mm-hmm. about New York, where it always seems the cities and the suburbs are at war with each other. One of the great economic forces in the region is the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, where city and suburbs contribute to it. City and suburbs rely on it for their economic well-being, and in some cases, particularly for the cities, for tourism and other cultural activities.
Larry, let me just jump in there. For those outside of New York, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority runs all the railroad, the Long Island Railroad, Metro North up from Connecticut, and the subway system in New York City.
Right. And, you know, in suburbs outside of Phoenix, creation of the light rail system a decade or so ago has caused an explosion of prosperity, both within the city and in the suburban communities. Same with Denver.
Speaking of that, suburban sprawl, and I know that Long Island has its limits, but other places that you mentioned, like Denver, do not. I mean, where does it end? You go to a place like Los Angeles, Houston, Dallas, Minneapolis, you just mentioned Phoenix, Atlanta, they keep expanding outward. And the retail areas are mostly strip malls and box stores. But with spectacular growth of online shopping, suburban retail is suffering. Major shopping malls around the country are closing down. Traffic in the suburbs is as clogged as it is in the major urban areas, and valuable farmland is being devoured for housing developments. I mean, what's next? Do we end up with an increase in the ex-urban population, the people who live like 30, 40, 50 miles away from core cities? What's the future look like?
What you've described is already happening, and it will to some degree continue to happen. Well, brick and mortar retailers in every space, you know, city, suburb, rural, are suffering and are still trying to figure out how to adapt to online commerce. And ironically, it's that development could have an impact on the proliferation of the kind of strip malls and even enclosed malls that you're describing. The increase in mass transit systems in some suburban areas, like outside of Denver and outside of Phoenix, may get people out of their cars, easier for them to return to the city, even if it's just for cultural events. It creates a relationship between city and suburb. There also are a lot of land preservation, farming rights, agricultural rights programs around the country, which limit the amount of rural and ex-urban land that can be turned into a shopping mall. So there is awareness around the country about the need to limit sprawl. Another thing we're seeing is, even pretty far from the cities, a lot of development, which is known as transit-oriented development, is taking place around these commuter stations, or they're being aggregated in, you know, mini urban centers out, village downtowns around the country, which you wouldn't even think of as a downtown in the traditional sense, but it's where people in a particular area, again, an ex-urban or rural area, you know, come together. And you're seeing more and more development like that taking place. So the future, and a lot of this just has to do with the economy. Residential sprawl was generally a reflection of the desire, the need for people to find more affordable housing. And of course, the farther you go, in most cases at least, the farther you go from the city centers, the cheaper the residential and commercial real estate is. There are exceptions, you know, depending upon, you might be near a university or you might
right.
be a major research facility like a national lab, but by and large, it holds true. So cost of real estate, protection of land, and the general economy has the most effect. Right now, housing costs are high. And one other thing, which I probably should have said first, which comes out of the pandemic and is probably with us permanently.
Virtual work.
Work from home. Nobody is quite sure how this could remake suburban life, other than that it will remake. For instance, it looks like 3-day in-office schedules, you know, so-called hybrid schedules, is going to become the norm. So the other days, people are going to work at home, or they might work in kind of communal clusters where other people, say, from the company, you know, may live in an area. And, well, why don't we just get together and make it an informal office space? People are going to want bigger homes. Apartment isn't going to get the job done for them and their family. So,
right.
And where will these places be? Well, they're probably going to be in existing village downtowns.
Yeah, I do consulting in New York. I found a lot of people go to work because they can't be around their family so much. and they can't get their work done.
That's right. And, you know, and people, look, I think there's something to be said about the social aspect of work beyond the idea of creating synergies by minds being together, you know, the so-called water cooler effect of new ideas and relationships. But I think just being with people, we're social beings. And it's one of the challenges of the suburbs is how do you facilitate that when people are basically living apart? My kids grew up, for example, for the most part, in a community that had really no center. There wasn't a Dix Hills Village Square, a couple of shopping malls or a lot of strip malls. And what became the village centers wasn't a geography. It was soccer teams, Boy Scouts. And wherever those meetings held and people came together, that was your village square.
You know, Larry, when I move around the country, and I do a lot, many suburbs are evolving into cities themselves. Yes. Like here in New York, you go to Long Island City, New Rochelle, Long Island City, White Plains, Jersey City. You now see dense downtown areas rivaling major skylines of other American cities. They once were suburban, but now they seem more urban. And
they're called edge cities. It's created havoc for the Census Bureau, beyond a political havoc that's recent years, particularly by the Trump administration. But how do you figure a Newark? How do you figure a White Plains? How do you figure a Stamford? Mm-hmm. They're a stone's throw from New York City, traditionally places where people commuted to New York City. But now they do, as you described, have skylines that you would, if you came across a potato field or a cornfield out in the Midwest, you'd say, my God, I've arrived in a big place. When they're just sort of, you know, little places compared to the Big Apple. But again, those are examples of more extreme examples of what's happening all over the place, where you're not seeing the 25, 30 story buildings that you'd find in Stanford or White Plains or New Rochelle even, but 3 and 4 and 5 story development, round train stations where people can find entertainment and other. This we're seeing more and more of.
That was what you were referring to a moment ago, the transit-oriented developments around transportation hubs, and they're creating little mini downtowns, urbanized centers where you can get on the train from the city, stop off and have dinner, entertainment, and it also, it's eliminating a lot of traffic and greenhouse gas going into our atmosphere.
That's the theory. I don't know if we've moved the dial very far, but that's sort of the idea. And we need to find a way. I know we're people way beyond Long Island are going to be listening to this, but in places like Long Island and in other suburbs, we need to find a way to attract young people who don't want to live in split levels, in a neighborhood filled with kids and dogs and cats and whatever. And we also need to find a way, frankly, to keep retirees who happen to have a lot of disposable income, but also don't want to live in a big house. And if you can build places that are interesting, where their friends still live, where their kids may still live, where their former colleagues, if they're retirees, still live, where they don't have to worry about driving, they can get on a train and go into the city or go the opposite direction, farther out. This is an important economic and social challenge for a lot of suburbs, and they're wrestling with it, and some do better with it than others.
So there are so many areas of the country, though, Larry, that are pushing to back off of mass transportation. Let's say Nashville, for example, had a plan to build a mass transit system all around the Nashville area, and it was killed by a number of politicians who wanted to keep cars and buses on the roads and keep building highways. And how do you create?
I think that a lot of that was partisan and racial politics, but there's an inevitability there. I remember years ago, I mean, this has got to be 50 years ago, when the proposals first came out to build a mass transit system around Atlanta. It was called
MARTA.
MARTA. I don't even remember exactly what it really stood for, but I remember I went down there to do a story for a business magazine on Atlanta. And one of the aspects was, how do people get around? And I remember interviewing people who were opposed to its expansion. Mm-hmm. And they called them, these are people who had no problem with a straight face saying, oh, you mean moving Africans rapidly
What it really means is the Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority. But I get your point.
But here's the what's interesting and ironic. Today, these suburban communities that fought the expansion, the predominantly white areas, basically the district that Newt Gingrich was elected from, mm-hmm. are now majority African-American and provided some of the largest majority for Joe Biden and for the two Democratic Senate candidates that determine control. Suburbs are changing, you know, to cycle back to that, again, partly as a result of different demographics of more people of color who are continuing to vote Democratic for a variety of issues. Although, you know, if you really want to get below the surface, there's some leakage toward Republicans from Latinos and Asians. That, mm-hmm. that political scientists and operatives are keeping an eye on. The other, and of course, it's half of the reason why the suburbs will again be decisive in the 2024 elections, basically the suburbs in a handful of states.
Well, I want to touch on that, but first I want to ask you about the Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra, which you're the executive dean. You're engaged in a number of research projects, including sustainability, water pollution abatement, developing renewable energy, transportation innovation, creating a carbon neutral environment, and suburban food production. How do you see those efforts progressing in the future?
The suburbs, you know, are easy to stereotype as a bunch of kind of self-absorbed, upper middle class white people who really don't care about anything outside their picket fences. And I can tell you that that's not true. Because of the interest in terms of funding, gifts, grants, contracts that we get to deal with very, very important issues. As you mentioned, we do at the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra, we do the water quality testing in major waterways as part of a state nitrogen abatement plan. And quality of water, and this is the other half of the reason, by the way, this of why the Democrats have been doing better in the suburbs and certainly in the last generation. Suburbanites have everything invested in their homes. And there's a much higher level of home ownership and business ownership, small business ownership. If you don't do something to protect the quality of the water, the quality of the air, the quality of the school, you're going to get a lot of pushback because that jeopardizes the value of the home. And the National Republican Party in the last 30, 35 years since the so-called Gingrich Revolution has given the impression to a lot of voters, fair or not, that they are not necessarily interested in protecting water quality and air quality, that they just as soon get rid of the Department of Education, as complicated as that is, gives a lot of people the impression they don't care about education.
And stripping the power from the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, things like that. So what's happened is you not only have different people living in these suburban areas, you also have a lot of very pragmatic people who have come to understand that, you know, they may not like paying taxes, but they need the things that the taxes, if they're spent wisely, are going to provide. And so they don't resonate to this anti-big government message. Also, particularly the women are moderate, not in the thrall of any political party. If you start to mess around with things they consider important, whether it's the education of their kids or their ability to make, you know, their healthcare decisions as reflected in abortion, you're asking as a political party for trouble. I can't tell you how often I've talked to Republicans who may still be Republican, but they are supporting a Democrat. And they say, I ask them why. They say, well, my party left me a long time ago. In other words, that it's not the Republican Party they knew back in the day. It's a different Republican Party, and they're uncomfortable with it.
Not, I left the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me.
Yeah, that's exactly you hear this phrase all the time. And there are blips in the movement on Long Island, for example, in 2022, when the rest of the country, particularly suburbs, held strong for the Democratic Party in the congressional race.
We went red.
We went red. Again, it shows you that one size fits all predictions, campaign policies don't always work.
Switching gears to another area of your expertise, which is politics. Larry, every time we turn around, it seems like we're headed for another election. You know, you get a little respite and then there's another one.
It's a little local.
Americans vote this November 2023 in a number of states for congressional, gubernatorial, and mayoral candidates. The majority of Americans, and you correct me if I'm wrong, about 55% now live in the suburbs.
Yep.
Now, we've had several major Supreme Court decisions recently, including Dobbs v. Jackson, a ruling stating the U.S. Constitution does not confer a right of a woman to have an abortion. Affirmative action in higher education has basically been eliminated, and LGBTQ protections have been restricted. Do you think the court's rulings will impact the suburban vote and influence their vote this year?
Probably. There seems to be a lot of energy, particularly with, you know, swing suburban, moderate suburban women on the abortion issue. By the same token, these same people are concerned about the prices they pay in supermarkets. They're also as concerned about crime. And we don't know how the so-called migrant crisis is going to play. In fact, in 2023, this November, I'm looking at a lot of local races for county executives and town supervisors and village mayors to see whether they are bellwethers that can give us a hint of where the country is, where these suburbs are heading into 2024. Even odd years are local elections. If there's a congressional election, it's a fluke to fill in an unoccupied seat.
The down ballot, not, you know, not the president, not Congress, not.
And 2023, I mean, there are some states that have gubernatorial races, other statewide races in odd years. But for the most part, those are even year elections. We're looking to see what issues are playing because, you know, sometimes a party's national brand is so tarnished that the candidates for local offices that have nothing to do with things like, say, abortion or immigration, they get wiped out in a blue or red tsunami. And we're kind of looking, and in the New York metro area, we're looking to see if fear of crime it still has the power it had to affect local races. And we're looking to see if abortion causes an equal and opposite reaction, you know, against Republicans. But again, it's the suburbs. It really is the suburbs.
Typically, as you mentioned, the economy and inflation, immigration, healthcare, crime, gun control, those are the big issues. But in 2023, Larry, do you think that the four Trump indictments, the big lie that he won the 2020 election and tried to overturn the vote, resulting in the RICO racketeering case in Georgia, the willful retention of top secret government documents, falsifying New York business records, and the porn star hush money payments are going to play a part? Plus, now we've got the House Republicans have opened up an impeachment inquiry into President Biden, and his son Hunter's problems are also front and center. Biden's age is a big issue, even though he's just 3 years older than Trump. Your thoughts, how does this play out in this election in 2023?
2023, I think all the things you're mentioning are going to rally the various bases of the party. But I think the typical voter who first has to decide if they even want to bother to vote in a local election, have much lower turnout in local elections than you do for state or national elections. They're going to vote on issues of personal and economic security. And if people feel the country's going in the right direction economically, if they see that inflation is starting to come down, if they believe that all the spending on infrastructure is going to improve their lives, then they will be more receptive to Democratic candidates. But if they're still afraid of what they're seeing in the newspapers and on TV, or if the migrant crisis just becomes a synonym in their minds, crime, if they still don't like what they're paying for eggs and milk at the supermarket, that could give an advantage to Republicans. And that's why we're keeping an eye on it.
What I don't understand, Larry, and help me out on this. Now, unemployment is at near record low. Inflation has been brought down from 9-10% to about 4%. It's true. You go to the grocery store, and I did it the other day. I was kind of shocked at some of the prices. But don't Americans know that a lot of this stems from outside issues. For example, the war in Russia and Ukraine, where grain prices are going up, where you have collusion between the Russians and the Saudis on the price of oil, keeping it up, and our gas prices are going up. Don't people see that?
Some people do. Most people don't get as granular. They have a big basket of issues that they care about, but you know, in terms of specifics, it really doesn't matter. I think that during the campaign season, I mean, the full campaign season,
right,
next year, people will have a better grasp. But again, it depends on what their source of information is. It depends on what's going on in their own neighborhood and in their families. And right now, people have a low opinion of Joe Biden. The best thing he's got going for him is they have a lower opinion of Donald Trump. While inflation is coming down, we got used to 2% on inflation for a very long time.
And mortgage rates were like 3%.
First mortgage was 9%, and I was thrilled to get it at late 70s, early 80s. You know, I mean, and now I've got a 2.76% mortgage.
But tendency to blame. The blame goes to Biden for the price of eggs and milk and gas.
Well, it always goes to the top. That's just the way it is. Fair or not, it's the way it is. And, mm-hmm. you know, Biden's challenge with people who still have an open mind. And I would argue that suburbanites, moderate suburbanites, you know, that there are plenty of red and blue people in the suburbs, but I think that there are more, you know, purple people, more open-minded people in suburban communities whose vote you can't predict and you may be able to persuade, who are in these suburban communities. And those are the ones that a guy like Biden and Trump are going to have to try to reach. If Biden, you know, probably has a strong case to make in relative terms, but it depends on what your backdrop is.
Some are calling the election in 2024 the most important election of our lifetime. You know, it is a possible rematch between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, who, by the way, is confronting 91 criminal charges and has been impeached twice. But his core is still there. He's still the front runner. But beyond the presidency, Larry, Congress is extremely contested. The Senate has 49 Republicans, 48 Democrats, and 3 independents who typically vote with the Democrats. The House of Representatives has 222 Republicans, 213 Democrats, and 1 vacant seat. Razor, razor thin margins in both houses of Congress. Mm-hmm. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but how influential will the suburban vote be in 2024?
Absolutely decisive. There are no more, and this may even be a stretch, but there are no more 40 competitive seats out of 435.
Mm-hmm.
Almost. And virtually all of them are either wholly or substantially suburban.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the suburban voter. It's the suburban sensibilities, the suburban pragmatism that will carry the day. How it's carried, anybody's guess.
You know, we've 15 months left until the November 2024 election. I mean, that's around the corner.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, a lot can happen. Things that we can't even predict that could send it reeling one direction or another. There are the court cases that you mentioned. There are potential geopolitical crises out there, and you can almost never predict the way Americans are going to react to it politically, the impact that these things could have on the economy. There is the potential health of both candidates being not exactly, you know, young chickens.
Mm-hmm.
If something happened in that realm, or something that fed into the image of Biden or Trump being too old to handle the job. What are Republicans going to do, both professional and just rank and file voters, if Trump is convicted?
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that Republican members of Congress in suburban areas, moderate swing suburban areas, are petrified of having to, you know, of being seen as defending anything that smacks of extremism. Think about suburbanites. They really shy away from extremism of any stripe. And over the years, as we discussed earlier, it's been the National Republican Party that in most of these suburbs has been seen as too, or at least more extreme than the Democrats. when there is urban crime spike, that can affect suburban thinking like it did on Long Island in 2022. Mm-hmm. So it's really up for grabs. And that's, you know, that's why I get to make a living. I specialize in suburban sensibilities, you know, from arts to zoology.
Do you think in the end next year, it will be Biden and Trump?
Barring some seismic shift or event? Yeah. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to say that. And I think anybody guessing it's going to be somebody else is just, they're throwing it out there so that they could say, you see, I told you so. And if they're wrong, nobody's ever going to pay attention to it. When you have a candidate at this stage of the primary season with such an enormous lead, there's no historical precedent, I think, at least, dissipating. And Biden, you know, right now has no challenge. I mean, there are people sniping from the sidelines about how, you know, Democrats should have a choice, but it's not happening. So he's on his way to cruising to the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, if he has, God forbid, something happens, and I extend the God forbid to Trump as well,
mm-hmm.
Something happens to him medically or something we can't even conceive of, it's going to be that rematch you described.
Only the heavens know for sure what's going to happen next
year. Well, what I can say, you know, and I don't like crystal ballism at all, but what I can say that is if it is Biden and Trump and the suburbs are the swing vote as they have been since George Bush the senior's first race, and that's going back a ways, if they are the decisive vote, Trump starts out behind because he did not do well in the suburbs in his second go around.
And he, in his first go around against Hillary Clinton, he lost the popular vote.
Well, he lost the popular vote, but he carried those swing suburban areas.
Yes, that's true.
One.
Only time will tell. And Larry, we are running out of time. Hopefully we'll revisit the voting issue next year as we head in for what could be a revolutionary turning point in our nation's politics. And I want to thank you so much for taking time and discussing this with me today.
And I thank you for giving me the time to discuss it with you today.
Thanks again, Larry. And I'm Jim Paymar, and you have been listening to The Big Shift, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening today, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Big Shift. It's coming soon.